Good morning. You're listening to WAAT 750 on your dial. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski with Children Come First. We're here every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m., and we talk about issues regarding children, the many issues of children, education, preventative health, family needs, and this morning we have Dr. Arnold Hillman. Dr. Hillman has been formerly the executive director of the 3,000 square mile, 33 student Riverview Intermediate Unit, a regional educational service agency to 17 school districts and communities in northeastern Pennsylvania. He's presently associated with Bright Futures Unlimited, a consulting and advocacy firm devoted to bringing schools and communities together to solve local problems. As with all of his efforts on behalf of schools and communities they serve, Dr. Hillman brings a particular can-do approach to his work. Good morning, Dr. Hillman. How are you?
Good morning, Daria. I'm doing real well.
Good. You have a wonderful radio voice, by the way.
Well, thank you very, very much. Maybe I can get a regular program.
Well, you'll have to listen to our sponsor. He's very good at trying to bring people on board for new radio broadcasts. Let's talk a little bit about some of your work, Dr. Hillman. You have been part of an intermediate unit. For people who don't understand the system of operation in Pennsylvania, how do intermediate units operate?
Well, intermediate units were formed in 1970 as a result, quite frankly, of the consolidation of 2,500 school districts into 501. They're service agencies between the Department of Education and the local school district. They provide services to schools that either can't do it individually, so they do it cooperatively, or they provide services that are pretty esoteric. They do things like bulk purchasing, anything that can be done in a consolidated way, whether it's technology or handling severe and profoundly handicapped youngsters. And they're generally pretty good. People have figured out that for every buck an IU spends, maybe you save $7 in educational expenses. I ran a very large IU at 34,000 kids in the IU, and did that for about 10 years.
Now, I'm not quite sure that I understand the functions of intermediate units. Do they train people, or are they just a segue from the legislative or the Department of Education to the IU to the school districts? Is that the way they operate?
Well, in fact,
or is it handicapped? Or I mean, how is it related?
Well, there are basic services that they're supposed to provide by law. One of them happens to be special education. They are more reflective of what the school districts in an area might need. So the districts in your particular area might need different kinds of services, not just special ed. They might need curriculum services. Some of them are too small or, frankly, too poor to do it on their own. So they would secure those services from the intermediate unit. Frankly, the IU's services are as broad as the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Set down in law in the school code. They have no direct relationship in terms of telling people what to do, which nobody wanted, not like the old county system. So the state views them as kind of purveyors of services to local school districts. They're not directed by the state. They are run by a local board, one of each of the local school districts.
Where are you located now?
I am in the Harrisburg area. I moved there from Clarion about 7 or 8 years ago, so I wouldn't spend 50,000 miles on the road.
And what is Bright Futures Unlimited?
It's a consulting and advocacy firm formed by my wife. I worked for her about, I guess now 13 years ago, to try and help rural youngsters go on to further education. And it's expanded to help organizations kind of meet their own needs, their own goals, whether they're private companies and whether they're rural communities, school districts, counties, municipalities. We do a lot of different things. Sometimes we even charge for it.
Now, Let's help our audience understand some things. We throw words around in education, and most people, for the most part, I've discovered, don't understand a lot.
Right.
Could you tell our audience the different types of school districts? You mentioned rural, there's metropolitan. Will you define the different and give an example of each one for us?
Well, Pennsylvania is the number one rural state nation. There are 40 definitions of rural, so when you get into, you know, definitions of rural, it's really tough. But essentially, they are areas that don't have a major city in them. They are sometimes 2,500 people and less, not near a major city. 42 of our counties out of 67 are 50% rural. Does that mean that Luzerne and Lackawanna County are rural? In some ways, they are. Philadelphia is obvious. Pittsburgh is obvious. They're cities. We have 3,700,000 rural people who live in the kind of areas I describe. What's a rural school district around your area? Well, if you look in Tioga County, northern and southern Tioga, some of the Pocono Mountain areas, used to be Crestwood was rural. It's becoming more of a suburb now. Things change. Hazleton and Wilkes-Barre and Scranton are city areas. Some of our rural areas, like outside of Harrisburg, have become absolute suburbs. So things change, but those are at least my definitions. There are about 219 out of 500 school districts that are absolutely rural.
Now, what are the different definitions of all the school areas in the state? You've mentioned rural, city. Are there any others? There seems to be some gray areas in between.
Oh, yes, there are. And, of course, suburban school districts,
right,
which surround the large cities and in some cases, you know, the smaller cities. There are many, many gray areas as the economy changes. For instance, Blair County out west where Altoona is. Now, Altoona is a city. The rest of Blair County is absolutely rural. The same thing is true of Williamsport in Lycoming County. It is definitely a city, but surrounding it are completely rural areas. And, of course, those of you who go to Penn State games and you see all the green stuff, you know, as you approach and as you leave. State College is a metropolitan area, but the entire surrounding area is really rural.
Well, it's interesting because I've listened to legislators talk, and I really don't hear them talking about rural school districts. For the most part, they're talking about, it seems that they've forgotten rural and speak more of the city and the suburbs. Am I hearing something correctly?
You are 100% correct. It's interesting. I do lobbying on behalf of rural schools, and when I first started, the eyebrows were arched when I walked in that I represent rural schools, as if, you know, whoever heard of that. And, of course, most of us realize the metropolitan models really don't work for rural people.
That's correct. Now, how can we possibly, let's take a little step back here.
Sure.
How can we possibly think of, you know, there are pros and cons to all this we'll be talking about, I'm sure.
Sure.
How can we think about rural legislating for an entire state when we've got so much diversification between Philadelphia, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, and then the rural areas like Clarion? How can we and even the difference between Philadelphia is a large city and perhaps Wilkes-Barre is a small city.
Yeah, we are a state of diversity, probably one of the most beautiful states in the nation, if not the most beautiful. It really is tough, Daria. And all things that happen are compromise. Rural legislators who are in a minority position might be able to, through joining hands with city people or suburban people, do some things for themselves. There are trade-offs in legislation. We have something that was appended to the old school funding formula that was called small district assistance.
Small district what?
Assistant.
Uh-huh.
Where you got a certain number of bucks per kid if your district was small enough. Those kinds of things resulted from compromise between legislators and administrators, or the administration. Some administrations, and this is not a Democratic or Republican thing, were more attuned to certain parts of the state because of their own physical background. Some governors came from cities, some governors came from rural areas, and so some of them understood different things, and some of them had to be educated. And it is, frankly, very tough.
Well, I can't imagine legislators' job in terms of trying to create legislation and being able to appease everyone in such a diverse state as Pennsylvania is.
Well, I know that they try, and it is very, very difficult. I really don't envy them. And there are, frankly, if you watch PCN, you'll see there are really terrible arguments sometimes on this particular subject.
Now, what are the major differences that you see between rural and city schools?
Well, when you say city, are you talking about suburbs too?
Yes.
Okay. Generally speaking, the rural areas and the city areas have much more in common to them do with the suburban areas. For instance, the levels of poverty. People often think of the cities as the poorest places, when in fact, according to the Department of Education, they're not the poorest places. Some of the poorest places are the hidden places in rural areas. There are similarities between the city areas in not just levels of poverty, but social problems, teen pregnancy, and things of that nature, and attention paid to them by the central administration, be they Republican, Democratic, it doesn't matter. There has been a feeling amongst both the city people and the rural people that they have been, I won't speak for anything other than education, and left out in the cold over the past 15 or 20 years. And so we try very, very hard to work together, but it's often very, very difficult because what goes well for a city area might not go well for a rural area. There are similarities in unemployment statistics. For instance, the top 20, I should say, the worst 20 unemployment counties are all rural. And of course, Philadelphia and some of the areas, the unemployment statistics are really bad also. It's a mixed bag, Daria, and there are, as I said, more similarities between those two than there are between suburban and city.
What about the quality of education in rural versus city?
Well, the wealthier you are, the more money you spend, the better your kids do. It's as flat as that. And anybody who tells you that money doesn't matter, I'm more than happy to trade them. The numbers are absolutely clear. The more money spent on schools, the smaller the class sizes, more resources, the more advanced placement courses, the more equipment, the more facilities, and I'm just using more. There's also quality. For instance, some rural schools are very, very, very good in terms of their facilities, but when you go into the science lab, there's nothing there. Classes are much larger in size, so individual attention. Over the past 10 years, the cost of special education has risen so dramatically, wealthy places can handle it, poor places can't. If you believe that you're a product of where you live and that's the kind of education you can get, you're falling into the trap of probably the most insidious kind of discrimination, and that's called placism, being treated by where you live. That should not happen, which is why we went to court 8 years ago, Daria, to try and equalize a little bit.
You are listening to WAAT 750 AM on your radio dial. This is Children Come First with Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We are here today, as we are every Tuesday, from 10 to 11 a.m. Today we're speaking with Dr. Arnold Hillman, who's been a former IU director and now works with Bright Futures Unlimited as a consultant and an advocate, working with rural schools and communities. We're talking a little bit about, I want to know about quality in terms of education. Now, basically, you've just told me that the more money they have, does that refer to quality as well?
Yeah.
Really? Seriously? That's discouraging.
I'm afraid that that's true. Is it true in every single case? No.
Okay.
It is not true in every single case. But if you do it statistically, it is. You look at the state test scores and things of that nature. And then you get into the question of what do you mean by quality? For instance, how do you measure whether a system is successful? Is it the number of kids who go on to college? Is it the SAT scores? The kids who succeed later on in life, which is my measure? Is it the number of kids who don't drop out? There are so many yardsticks to measure by that quality, it's not like measuring the quality of an automobile coming off the assembly line. Human beings are very, very inconsistent. When kids come out of school, do they have what they need to be successful in life? And those are the things that you can't measure at the moment. Some studies have been done by a guy named Card at Princeton University who followed...
I'm sorry, who? Carr?
C-A-R-D. Card and Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R, who followed youngsters from different schools and different levels of expenditure per school over a period of time that went past their 20s, I think early 30s maybe even, and found out that there is a relationship between the kind of schooling that they got and how much people spent later in life. These are the kinds of things that are really tough to measure because you have to do longitudinal studies. I wish it was that simple. But generally speaking, not just from my experience, but also from statistics, it really doesn't matter what you give the kids. One of the biggest differences, there was an article in the Allentown newspaper about 9 years ago done by a fellow named Tim Reeves, who is now the governor's publicity person, who compared Northern Tioga to Upper Marion School District, which is in Montgomery County. And they're not the poorest, not the wealthiest, with 3,000 kids, and went down to how many teachers they had, how many extracurricular things they had. By the way, extracurricular activities do make a difference. They really do. I'm not just talking about sports. The opportunities. My own daughter went to a high school, a reasonably poor school district, where 72 kids graduated with her, and she went and was lucky enough to be in the governor's school for international studies down at the University of Pittsburgh, and she talked to the kids and asked them what they had. They had, like, debating classes, and they had all kinds of stuff that she never even heard of.
And also the things such as Odyssey of Mind and those types of activities.
Oh, sure, and even things like quiz bowls. And,
right.
And
History Day. Mock trial day.
Gosh, those are things that some schools have never even heard of. They try very, very hard. Very, very hard. But without the resources needed. And yeah, do some schools do a good job? Some do a bad job, even if one is spending less money and more money? Sure, that's true. That's human beings. But generally speaking, the more you have, it to me, the more people do well. I can't find any other way of saying that.
That's perhaps true of public schools, but traditionally, from what I've read, private schools who spend a lot less money on children per child, as far as statistically speaking, seem to have a product, and we have, for the most part in private schools, parents who do have a great deal of money, and yet those schools spend anywhere, especially parochial schools, $2,300 to less than the national average, which is around $6,700, $6,800 at this point, spend less money per child and yet have a greater quality education, or otherwise we wouldn't have these schools around, many of whom have been around for the last quarter of a century. These schools do not have the kinds of equipment, science equipment, technology that's available, and yet what happens is that they have curriculum that deals in depth rather than breadth, and they attribute that to the greater part of a child's education. How do you speak to that?
Disagree with almost everything you said.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. First of all, the $2,500 that the parents paid is only a small part, or maybe even one-third of the cost of what the child is doing. In many, many, I would say, wealthy private schools, money comes from endowments and things like that, as well as what the tuition is. And of course, tuition in the very, very posh private schools is well over $10,000 or $15,000 per kid, and their class sizes are unbelievably small. And that's why they succeed. But even in comparison to them, let's take Radnor School District, which is one of our finest school districts in the state. Their children in a public school spending less money than the wealthy private schools that are around the area outdo them in everything, including SATs. As far as certain schools having no equipment and things like that, I can't really tell you. I know that we spend $200 million in the state to supply equipment, books, and psychological services and all kinds of stuff to private and parochial schools, including, you know, transportation. The private schools exist because people choose for them to exist.
Now, however, tell me why they would choose for them if they're not doing creative.
Well, you see, there are other reasons why people send children to schools. One of them is religious, and that makes up a great deal. They would prefer that their children, and since I went to a parochial school when I was a kid, I can tell you, there were reasons other than the quality of the education. They want their children to be imbued with the morality of their particular religion. In actuality, and this is kind of a negative thing, I don't often say it, but in 1997, I think, if you rank all of the private and parochial schools' SAT scores across the nation, Pennsylvania comes out 48th out of 49th who report their scores in terms of SAT.
I'm sorry, you were moving away from your mic, from your
phone. I'm sorry.
Phone. In 1997, if you rank the private and parochial schools.
Private and parochial schools, when compared to each other across the 50 states, I think Colorado doesn't report their private and parochial school scores. Pennsylvania ranks 48th out of 49th in scores. The difference between the public schools, which accept all children, and they have to by law, difference between them and in terms of the SAT scores is really very, very small. And when you consider the vast number, almost 2 million kids who attend public schools in comparison to the 250 or 300,000 that attend private school, you know, that's pretty darn good, I think.
Now, wait a minute. I think I'm misunderstanding something here, maybe because your voice trailed off.
Sorry.
This ranking mm-hmm. was private versus parochial schools?
No,
or private and parochial
private
schools?
Private and parochial schools.
So their test scores in the state of Pennsylvania rank them 48th in the nation in scores. Is that correct?
Compared to other private and parochial schools in the other states, yes.
So we're virtually at the bottom here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and in terms of private, and you have to remember, you have to look at all the kinds of private schools that there are in Pennsylvania. They're not all parochial. They're not all private.
Yes.
All of different kinds. There are many, many small little schools that are religiously oriented and privately oriented. So you have to throw all of those in a pot.
Now I have a question to ask.
Sure.
What was the ranking of the public schools in that 1990?
44th or 45th.
Okay.
Right, which isn't great. That's amazing. It's not that great. But